You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 543. We got a packed house tonight. We got a cool show. We got a special guest. So stay tuned to find out who that special guest is.
Isn't life a blast? It's just like living in the past. And we go downtown to do our shopping, and we work in suburbia. But I say,
and we're back, and it's the Punk News Podcast, number 543, only 7 episodes away from 550 already. We're not going to do mail this week because we got a lot to talk about, and we got a cool guest, so we don't want to waste time with mail. But you can always reach that podcast at punknews.org, and we'll just do some super quick intros so we can start talking to our new friend. First of all, we're here with Sam Barrett. Sam Barrett, what's happening?
Hi, I'm here. I'm alive.
Always a good start. We're here with M-Moore. M-Moore, what's happening up there in Canada?
Hello. It's still going. Got a vaccine appointment booked for my mom, so that's a bonus.
Woohoo!
Woo! Yeah!
Honestly, people, it's looking like... Well, actually, Hallie Bullitt, give me some feedback here. So, word on the street was a certain somebody that's putting out a book was going to do an outdoor show in August to promote said book. And honestly, it's being particularly difficult. And also, all the medium bookers are booking up the indoor venues. Indoor venue, Hallie Bullitt, August. Too scary or just scary enough?
Oh, man.
Tough question, right? Tough question. You don't have to answer if you don't want to.
I would do it. Well, listen, I can only answer for myself. I would definitely do it if it was a show I really wanted to go to, and I would just wear my mask. So I feel like as long as it's a show that people, I don't know, does everyone have the same thinking as me?
You know, in punk, there's that weird thing where you go so far to the left, you come back around to the right again. And a lot of people, you know, aren't really worried about it at all, you know. Yeah. So that's kind of a thing. So we'll see. But listen, speaking of shows that people want to see, we're here with our special guest, a man that was on TV, a man that has been in the movies, a man that has done many wonderful hours of stand-up comedy. He's conquered every mountain there is. He's swam through every sea that there is. He's traveled on every path, and he's back, and he's at the height. He's not even at the height. He's still climbing. We are here with the man, the myth, the legend, the champ, Chris Gethard. Chris, thank you for being on the show, man.
That was by far the greatest intro I've ever received in anything.
You just need to John to travel around with you and intro you everywhere you go.
Yeah, I feel so good right now. Swam every sea and climbed every mountain.
You know, Chris, I was thinking about you all week, and I one quote kept coming back to me, and it's Alexander wept when he learned the vastness of his domain because there were no more worlds left to conquer. Do you feel that way?
No, I mostly feel confused and stressed out, as anyone who loves me will tell you.
Well, see, that's the funny thing is that quote that I just gave you is actually not a real quote. It's from Die Hard. It's a severe corruption of a quote by Plutarch. The quote actually attributed to Plutarch is when Alexander learned of the possibility of endless worlds from Abraxas, he wept. And when asked why he was crying, he replied, "How is it fair that there are infinite worlds and we can't even master one?" So you think that's more fitting toward your life?
Yeah, that seems far more emo and desperate in a way that I think matches much better. Yeah.
So you think Alexander was emo and desperate, and do you think that's why he like conquered most of the ancient world, because he felt he was lacking something?
Listen, I'm not trying to slam anybody. I'm not trying to start any controversy with all these people out here who love Alexander. So I'm not trying to – the last thing I need is to divide the punk scene over their notoriously passionate opinions about Alexander.
But, you know, when it comes to Alexander, you know, some people love him and some people hate him. But anyways, the point being, Chris Gethard has got a new special. I've seen it. It's great. It's called Half My Life. And it's kind of half stand-up special, half documentary about now that he's, you know, he's a grown man, he's got a kid, he's got a family. And what he does is he goes to 10, I'll say alternative venues or 10 unusual venues, and he does this comedy there. And like I was saying before the show started, like I thought I liked stand-up comedy, and I guess I kind of do, but I realized that when I watch most stand-up comics, I don't laugh at all. I think, oh, that's amusing, but I don't actually laugh. With Chris's special, I laughed a lot on it because there are some parts that are really, really funny, and I thought it was quite poignant. So my question, Chris, to bring it back to Alexander, and I'm not going to make you give an opinion on whether or not you think Alexander's military campaign was sound or just lucky, but the question is you purposely throw yourself into these difficult venues. You go to a pancake breakfast. You go to not Crocodile World, Alligator World, someplace
Gator
they've
Land.
Got Gatorland, yeah. Where they've got live alligators, and you do comedy for live alligators in there, and it's wild and it's crazy. So are you specifically trying to make comedy harder for yourself?
A little bit, actually. And before we even get into that, let me say that I think when you're strategizing a military campaign, you can be both skilled and lucky. You know, sometimes those things both need to happen. So
well said. Well said.
Again, not trying to shake up people's Alexander opinions. But yeah, I mean, I don't know that I'm – I guess I do kind of like to make it a little harder for myself, a little challenging and – I think mostly I just don't want to do the same old stuff. I think there's a lot of comedy specials out there now, and you know, Netflix is putting out 100 a year alone, and I just sit there, I go, they all kind of feel the same and look the same. And I think that even when I'm doing stand up, it tends to be very different, and oftentimes my shows will kind of take left turns and kind of descend into some chaos, and I like that. And that's part of why I wanted to do 10 shows, because we get, you know, the shows you mentioned. We have footage from the Auto Bar in Baltimore where a girl got on stage and was like demonstrating wrestling moves on me, and it really hurt. And in Detroit, people started jumping on stage. So I kind of like when things go wrong, and I sort of like when the audience's expectations of what the show they're going to see, you know, when those expectations get upended. So I just wanted to try to do it in a cool way, and also sort of show that it's not really like a glitzy or glamorous thing. It's, you know, a lot of sitting in cars and killing time, and then you go and you do the show, and that's the part of the day that feels good.
In the special, you talk about how you could do bigger venues, and in fact, you just played Asbury Park to a sold-out show, and word on the street was the show was fantastic. Now that you've got a level of success, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's funny because I don't always feel successful. I still every day sit there and sort of wonder about my standing in the comedy world and what I should do next. And but objectively, I can take a step back and go, I've we had the TV show, I had the HBO special, I wrote a few books. That all happened before I was 40. I'm like, that's the resume of a successful person. But I think I learned a long time ago that like professional accomplishments, they don't fix what's broken. You know, I think a lot of us, we spend so much time chasing, like if I could just get X, Y, and Z, then I'm going to feel good about myself and I'll prove everybody wrong. And that was definitely like a motivating attitude for me for many years. And then I did enough stuff where I was like, I'm never going to achieve something that kind of solves my demons. Like that's going to be therapy and medication that solves my demons. So I think I could probably play slightly larger venues. I have a tour coming up later this year where they're going to bump me up to a few more seats, but I don't love I think the most people I ever performed for at once was 12,000 people. I did stand up for 12,000 people.
Damn. What's that?
Yeah. It was wild. And it was the reason I got this gig was we lived in Queens at the time, and my agent called me, and it was this agent who's like a big shot. He never called me directly, pick up, and he's like panicking. He's like, "You live in Queens?" I was like, "Yeah." And he told me there was this like very famous comedian performing at the Forest Hills Tennis Stadium who forgot to book openers for the gig. So he's like, how long until you can get to Forest Hills? I was like, it's the next stop on my subway. If I catch the express, I can be there in like 20 minutes. And then half an hour later, I was on stage in front of 12,000 people, you know? And there's a lot of excitement to that, and I get the rush, but you know, people aren't even watching you at that point. They're watching the screen. There, you know, there's a camera pointing at you, projecting you onto a big screen. To me, you know, the music I liked coming up, I was seeing it in VFW halls and church basements. And when I do shows, I like being able to make eye contact with people. I like that if I want to do crowd work, I can talk to the person in the last row because they're not that far away. And a lot of that might be rationalizing because I can't sell 12,000 tickets by a long shot. But there's also something to be said for, you know, what am I doing it for? Am I doing it for my ego, or am I doing it so that the people in the room can have a good night? And I prefer the second one, and I think intimacy is really important for that.
Often you reference like punk rock in the Chris Gethard show in your special, in your specials. Like, what were like the punk bands that you were when you first learned about punk and were getting into punk? What were the punk bands you were checking out? What were the shows you were going to? Because I don't know if you've ever actually talked about that, honestly.
Well, I grew up in North Jersey in the 90s, and there was a very, very strong scene then. When I was in high school and early college, there was a scene called the NJPP, North Jersey Pop Punk. And the first show I ever saw, I remember it was One Nature, who, great band. Someone sent me their whole discography, and I still like it. Felix Frump, who were very nice guys who played every show in Jersey. And it's a band called The Missing Children, whose lead singer went on to be in The Degenerics. Now he's in Warriors. Frank Pagaro. So
I know Frank. Frank's a good dude. Frank Pagaro features heavily in The Architect of Self-Destruction, The Oral History of Leftover Crack, prominently in the Star Fucking Hipster section. I'm sorry, Chris. Go ahead.
No, please. Get the plugs in. And but yeah, and then, you know, like the big band in that NJPP scene was Humble Beginnings, and Gabe from Humble Beginnings went on to found Midtown. And, you know, his Big Wig played a lot of shows back then. And then, as I was kind of expanding beyond North Jersey, my big bands were, who did I love in high school? I really loved Jay Church. I love Jay Church to this day. I think Jay Church is kind of sadly forgotten, and, you know, Jawbreaker. And I really loved the Mr. T Experience. I was weirdly very into Servotron, that band on Lookout that dressed up like robots. So, you know, a lot of pop punk and a lot of sort of the more melodic hardcore that was about feelings and stuff like that.
We have a division that we talk a lot about on punk, and I'm just interested in your perspective here. On one side of punk, punk is the destruction zone, the chaos zone. Anything goes, the craziness, it's the craziness zone. It's whatever you want to do, even if it's dangerous or scary, that's cool. Then on the other side, there's the I don't fit in club. So I'm joining this club because there's people here that don't fit in like me, and I can get along with them. And the internal dynamic, if you will, between those two scenes is, one is, this is dangerous, this is crazy, this is supposed to be scary. And the other is, this is your safe zone because the rest of the world isn't safe to you. What's your perspective on that dynamic? And maybe you disagree with my setup there.
That's a really great question. I think that, like, the project that I made that most reflects the fact that I came up punk, it was definitely the public access version of the Chris Gethard show that Hallie and I were both on. I think it had both elements. I think you look at those studio audiences, and I think there's a lot of people who probably don't feel like they have another community to go to, and we built our own. So definitely feels like the safe. You know what I would say is, I kind of feel like the destruction vibe, which I still like. Like, even the Gethard show, we had shows where like kickboxers were beating me and like all sorts of insanity and stuff. And a lot of it was to kind of be shocking and violent and just weird for the sake of it. But I think that the destruction vibe to me seems a little bit like more of the old school punk vibe. And the sort of bastion of creativity and safety seems new. I've said this to many friends of mine. I really, really love that today when you go to a DIY space, generally one of the presupposed things is like, this space is safe. You can come hang out. You're going to be safe here. And this will sound like the grumbly guy who's 41 years old talking about back in the day. I'm not saying this to romanticize it. I go, when I was going to shows back in Jersey, I remember Like if a skinhead showed up, everybody was trying to see what color their shoelaces were because we didn't know if they were a Nazi or, you know, if like 10 kids all showed up at the same time in hoodies, we're like, oh, it's those youth group kids from Bergen County. They're going to beat us up again. Like it didn't really feel safe at all. It felt very dangerous and unsafe in certain ways. So to me, it's more of a generational divide than like a current choice. But I don't know. I could be totally wrong on that. You guys are the experts.
You bring up in your new special, Half My Life, you bring up a really interesting point. And also you actually just did an interview with Jeff Rosenstock over the Talk House, where you guys, discussed this as well. You briefly mentioned that, said, well, maybe I don't need to be danger comedy anymore. Maybe I can just talk about, you know, being a dad and stuff. So I'm interested, was that just an off the cuff statement? And you really are interested in like the weird confrontational or just semi-dangerous comedy from the early era of the Chris Gethard show, or are you morphing into something else? Where's your perspective at now, and what does that mean?
Well, I think at the end of the day, comedy that is good is inherently honest. I think comedy is an art form where when someone's being disingenuous or fake, you can sniff it out pretty quickly. And if somebody's disingenuous and fake and gets a lot of success, I feel like you start to hear about other comedians grumbling about them because it just doesn't go far. You have to be honest. And like right now, I have a 2-year-old son and I worry a lot about lawn care. Like it's my greatest passion right now outside of my family is lawn care. I got mouse ear chickweed all over my lawn right now. I hate it. Last year I had crabgrass, so I guess the chickweed's an improvement. And like I care about that. And so that's what I can write jokes about. And you know what I was saying with Jeff is I think, and it might come back. Who knows? I might find some fire in the guts again about something. But for now, I look at the old Gethard show. When it went to public access in 2011, it felt like a really progressive show, I think. It was talking about mental illness pretty frankly. There were a lot of sort of outcasts hanging out in the same room in a way that I think attracted a lot of an audience across the country to call in and be like, hey, like, this public access thing is my thing too. It felt shocking. Now I don't think it does. Now I think it would look like a really white environment that isn't, you know, I think the mental health conversation isn't as shocking as it was 10 years ago. And thank God for that. But I think about that and sometimes I take a deep breath and I go, I don't have to hang on to being that guy forever because it's not totally honest anymore. And one of the things that I think a lot of people in my position, you know, having had some success, having tried to do my part, I certainly feel like when we went to cable, if you look at my writer's room, I hired a lot of people for their first job and a lot of people who were very different from each other. That was years ago before it was like buzzy to be woke. I did it because I was like, these are great people. And the more perspectives in the writer's room, then the more ideas I'm allowed to do. Like it seemed simple to me. But at this point, one of the best things I can do is recognize that there are comedians out there who have a lot of things to say, and they should be the ones to carry the mantle of kind of being the troublemakers, because my life is truthfully a little bit calmer than that now. And I look at people like, for example, Patty Harrison, who's one of the funniest people going right now, where I go, yeah, like, Patty is so good and is a trans woman and completely unapologetic and like funnier than everyone and doesn't really make identity even a part of the act. It's just, I'll get up here and be the funniest one and you now all have to deal with it. There's people like that. My friend Meg Stalter, who I think is doing such brilliant stuff. And then there's like so many comics, Chloe Hilliard, Monroe Martin, Roy Wood Jr., I think should be an absolute household name. These are all people who I think are maybe, you know, in the trenches fighting fights right now that need to be heard about. And if I was trying to hang on to who I was in the past just to kind of hang on to that audience or to sort of strategize about how to sell tickets or stay cool, well, then I'm kind of taking up oxygen that's, it's more valuable for other people to have it right now. That space of kind of being the troublemaker who's trying to mess with the status quo, there's other people who need to mess with the status quo right now, and I should get out of their way. And I think there's just a lot of truth to that. And plus, my lawn care jokes are very funny, so that works too.
Well said, and how point. Just a couple of last questions. You talked about I forgot where I was going with that. With regards to the venues on the new special, which venue do you think was particularly interesting or challenging? I mean, the Otter Bar is cool, and it's a punk club or a metal club or whatever. But which venue, which was most unusual, really stood out to you, and how did that affect your performance?
Oh, I love this question. First of all, the Otto Bar is my favorite venue in the country.
Why? I mean, the Otto Bar is cool, but why?
Oh, it's just the best. Every time I go there, I have a good show there. You know, I think coming from the music background, I get accepted in places like the Otto Bar. And there's other comedians that go in there, but I think the crowd that place attracts tend to be on my wavelength. And I think they start to sense, like, you know, this guy is to some degree or other one of us. And music venues have done me well. The Colony in Woodstock in the special, another just great place. The Otto Bar, so good. I mean, the Gators, doing comedy for Alligators, that was the most challenging. But as far as the real venues, I guess it's two answers. One was that spot, Buffalo, in Buffalo Sugar City, that was a DIY space. They closed because of COVID, and it stinks because that space was really good. It was really nice. The backstory on the morning show there is I had sold out a show. I think it was on Friday night. They said, hey, why don't you stay till Saturday? I said, well, I'm doing a show in Detroit on Saturday, so I got to drive. They said, what if we do a 9 a.m. show and we serve everybody breakfast? And so it was their idea. And I was like, cool, that sounds hard. And then it was made even more difficult when they went to cook all the pancakes on hot plates and they blew out all their fuses. And there's a lot of jokes in the special where I was genuinely starting to freak out because I'm like, you can't drag people out at 9 in the morning, tell them they're going to have food, and then not give them food. Like, that's nobody wants to be pissed off and hungry and tired and watch comedy in the morning. So that was really hard. And then the other one is I make a joke in the special when I'm performing in Richmond. I say the venue looks like the fanciest college lecture hall I've ever been in. And that was one of the only venues on this whole documentary that my agents booked instead of me doing it personally. And it really shows. It was like in this weird, like the main room that night had like an opera or chamber orchestra or something. I was like, what am I doing here? And didn't sell that many tickets. And then the promoter screwed me on the money and it really messed with my head. And then my buddy Carmen, who's in the dock with me, who comes on the road with me, he had a friend who pulled me aside because people were stopping me on the streets in Richmond. And that doesn't happen most places. People are stopping me. Oh, Broad City. Oh, your public access show. I'm like famous in Richmond. And that show, we didn't sell any tickets. And my friend Carmen, his buddy goes, it was a comedian in town. He goes, dude, I don't know if this is going to make you more or less angry, but I can name like literally 8 venues off the top of my head where you would have crushed it. I have no idea why they put you in that whack ass place. And that was very hard. That was very hard. Sorry, I'm rambling.
Well, Chris, we all love to hear you ramble, and you always have insightful things to say. So the special is called Half My Life. It's really funny. I know you can get Hulu and Apple TV. Is that where you can get it, Chris, or where can you check it out?
It's on Apple TV and Amazon and YouTube and I think Peacock and even that weird one Tubi that you never open on your Roku. So it's streaming in all these different platforms. You just got to look for it. I wish it was as easy as saying, hey, it's at blank, but you got to search it out a little, but I hope people like it. And John, I thought you might get a kick out of it. Now that you've seen it, this might make sense, but when I was 14, I got a VHS copy of Another State of Mind. And
yes,
I still obsessively love that movie. And I rewatched it before we went out and shot this, and I couldn't believe how much of it I remembered. And now that you know that, I think you can see this is in many ways, this is kind of my ripoff of Another State of Mind. And I'm proud of that.
Well, people should definitely watch Chris's special first, then watch Another State of Mind. I think I always thought that the Stern Brothers Youth Brigade came off way better than Social Distortion, but that's just me. Chris, last question. People definitely should check out Chris's thing. It really is good. It's one of his better things, and it's definitely rad. Chris, in the Battle of Tyre, Alexander chose to blockade the port in order to weaken the city, and then he attacked. The problem was that gave the city time to kind of fortify, and of course that ended up costing Alexander about half his navy, so he ended up destroying the city. A lot of ancient historians at the time said he should have attacked right away in order to get some initial strike in and get the city to collapse quickly, and there would have been fewer casualties on both sides. What's your stance on that famous debate?
I just feel like if you're going to run a naval blockade, the whole point is to keep out supplies and goods, right? So you better make sure they don't have a stockpile of those things on the inside, or else you're just wasting time. Seems to me like he probably overthought it, and it was a little bit of a cute move instead of the sensible move.
Well said, Chris. Well said indeed. Chris, let's play a tune, and we'll come back, and then we'll hit the news. What do you want to play, Chris?
This is a song that came out a few years ago. I hope it's okay, and I actually used it as the opening theme to the Half My Life special because I love this song so much, and it's a local Jersey band. They're not people I'm friends with. I found out about them through the Jersey Grapevine, and I think this song is so good. It's a band called Spouter, and it's a song called Pulp.
Pope, another excellent selection by Chris. Let's hit the news. For the news, I'm not going to do a whole lot of talking here because we got a packed house, so I'm just going to sit back. I got a couple of thoughts on a couple of things, but I will kick off the football and we'll go from there. The Linda Lindas are the latest internet craze. It's a band of four young women. Well, not they're girls. I don't mean that dismissively. They're literally like 11 to 15 or something, and they have a song called Racist Sexist Boy, and when that went on the internet, it blew up and everyone thought it was the coolest thing ever. The next day or the day after that, Epitaph Records had signed them to a record deal. It's not exactly clear what the deal entails, but we'll have to see. So anyway, Epitaph Records is going to put out something by the Linda Lindas, a band of 11 to 15-year-old girls from the Los Angeles area who sing about social issues. Sam Barrett, what's your stance on the Linda Lindas?
So they just posted a little while ago, which we'll probably timestamp this recording, but anyways, that they actually have been in talks for a couple months about signing to Epitaph. So it wasn't just like a viral thing, but I am so into this. I am almost living vicariously through these ladies, these preteens, because I wished when I was young, I had the capabilities of putting together really angry music or sounds angry music and like saying all the things that I want to say. So I'm so about this. I'm so for this. I'm just so happy for them right now.
And what do you think?
I'm really glad that they got a deal. I'm really glad that they're getting more recognition. I think the song's really great. And I checked a little bit more out about them after the story on Punk News ran. And I found they do a cover of Rebel Girl by Bikini Kill. And it is nuts. It's really, really good. So I'm glad to see it. I hope more music comes from them soon.
Hallie Bull, here's my concern. I thought this song was cool. I think these young women or young ladies are rad and cool. Here's my concern. I'm being paranoid like I always am, but when you're half the time my paranoia turns out to be true. So I've learned to, you know, work with it. You know, there's lyrics in this song where they say, you're a blockhead, you're riffraff. I don't see an 11, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old person use it from LA using those phrases. Those are very much phrases from the 80s hardcore scene, you know, and before, you know. So I wonder, is this really for young ladies that have, let's start a band, this is what we wrote? Or is there someone, you know, behind that saying, I've got an idea for a real buzz band, you know? And even if they're not, and I'm not saying that's definitely the case here, even if this is for young women or for young ladies that have got this cool idea and this cool song, and this song rips, this is cool. Often when these little kids, they're little kids, when they get signed to a record label, it doesn't usually work out too long that well in the long run. I remember about 3 or 4 years ago, there was like three brothers that had this crazy heavy metal. And I'll look up the name once I'm done talking. They had like this crazy heavy metal and everyone was excited. And like the record never came out just because like it just wasn't going to work, you know. Or I can think of a couple of punk bands that start out when they were like 12 or 14. Old Skull is a perfect example. It's very hard to get beyond that. You know, when you're 13 and someone's like, they've got a record label for you, you're going to be famous. And you're like 13, I'm like, I'm going to be famous. And then when it doesn't happen because the music industry is extremely, extremely tough, you know, that could be very hard. Or the other, it's the American Idol thing. When they bring 12-year-old or 13-year-olds or 8-year-olds on American Idol or whatever, and the kid is cute and the kid can sing way better than most other 8-year-olds, but he's not or she's not ready for Las Vegas or whatever, they pass him along because they think they're cute. But then they get about halfway there and the 8-year-old, the 10-year-old is like, I'm going to win. And they get booted and they start crying and they're distraught. They're just too young to be in that arena. Why not wait till they're 18? You know, they're only going to get better. So that's the concern I have. Am I valid or am I being a grandma?
No, I think you're, I mean, well, first of all, you know, they're like the kids of famous people. Like
I heard that. I didn't know that. Who
yeah. So like the two of the girls, like their dad is like this Grammy award winning producer who's worked with like everybody. He's like worked with Jimmy Eat World and like Charlie Bliss, which is not to say that Charlie Bliss is huge, but like more current bands than Jimmy Eat World and like Tegan and Sarah and Paramore. I mean, like this, their dad is like a huge producer. So like, that made me, I don't know, there was something about that made me feel like, oh man, I think a little bit of the thing that you were feeling, John, of just like, well, is it like, is this something that's genuinely coming out of them? Or is this something that a parent was like, oh, here, like, this would be cute if you make a band. But then, I don't know, then looking at their stuff, like, I think it does genuinely, it's clear that it genuinely comes from them, and they're fucking talented. Like, the singer can sing. I'm, like, legit jealous of her voice. She's got that, like, Kim Shattuck thing where she can, it's like she can sing, but, like, she can also scream, and she can just kind of pick and choose what she feels like doing in any given moment. And, like, you know, I think there is something where, like, I just, because we're punks, I think we just can't help but wish that they were just, like, these nobody kids that just, like, came out of nowhere and, like, just knocked everybody on their asses. Like, the truth, that's not true. Like, they definitely have, you know, I think one of the other girls in the band, like, her dad founded Giant Robot, that magazine. Like, so they, you know, they're cool LA kids. They've been exposed to, like, a ton of cool shit their whole lives, and they have, like, a lot of connections and a lot of support. And that being said, they're, like, doing cool stuff. And actually, John, I'm wondering if that means that they actually will be able to withstand a lot of the just the pressure and the everything you were talking about, because they're not like, you know, middle school girls from, like, Idaho or somewhere that just got, like, plucked up by Epitaph. Like, I do think they're probably at least somewhat savvy about the entertainment industry because they've been around it. And I think maybe that just means that they're, like, up for this challenge. Like, they've got support. They sort of know what, probably have some idea of what they're getting into. And maybe they can just, I mean, I think their EP is great. So maybe they can just turn around and just, like, rock. Maybe they can just truly, like, rise to this opportunity and just fucking kill it. I think that would be very cool. I'm, like, very excited for them.
Chris, are they killing it, or do you share in my deep paranoia?
I walked away. I was watching it when it started going around, and I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. And then when it cut to the section where the drummer started singing, I found that quite impressive. I always like when the drummer sings. It seems like a really hard thing to do. I wish I had smarter opinions, but that's what I really walked away with. Man, it seems hard to sing while drumming.
Well, if Phil Collins and if Mike Yerkin can do it, then you know, you gotta have real talent. As a side note, people, Chris Gethard, Punk News mixtape number 2 with Mike Yerkin, closing out the grand finale. So, Chris, thank you for doing that. If you guys want to hear it actually might be the only Chris Gethard song track where he sings. Chris, is there any other place where you sing? Oh, you do have the Cry in the Wawa song, right? Like, isn't there a version of that?
I did. Myself and Malblum did a song called Crying at the Wawa. And then I recently, there's this group of Jersey punks doing a thing called Jersey Interchange, where I sang a cover of Weston's Just Like Kurt. So that's out there floating around in the world as well.
Well, if you want the very first Chris Gethard vocal song track, Punk News Mixtape number 2. Chris, thank you for doing that. M. Moore, Neighborhood Brass, the new album, Confines of Life. It's out by the time people hear this podcast. The two lead tracks are Who Took the Rain and Harvey Weinstein Is a Symptom. I dug it. Did you love it or did you hate it?
This was great. This was so good. I've listened to it about 3 times, and it's so good. I think the biggest surprise was All Nazis Must Die, and it's just instrumental, and it's awesome. It's so, so good. I thought the majority of it was really good. Like, none of the songs really stuck out as, like, bad. You know, like, there wasn't anything I skipped. And I'm definitely looking forward to listening to it more.
It's funny to talk about this, though, just on the heels of the Linda Lindas thing, though, because, like, this is another band. Like, is this a big band? Because this is, like, another one where, like, you look them up and, like, they recorded their album with, like, another Grammy-winning producer. I'm like, is that just, like, the L.A. scene? Is it just, like, everybody? I don't know. The L.A. music scene sometimes creeps me out. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
it seems like everybody's famous. Everyone's, like, famous, or, like the kid of someone famous, and everyone's, like, trying to, like, record their album with, like, a big producer. I don't, there's something about that like creeps me out. That being said, I thought this was great. But do you guys know what I'm talking about? It's just like, is this a big band? Like, should this big band be recording with like a Grammy winning producer? Or is that just something that happens in LA?
I think so. I mean, like Neighborhood Brats, like their money does not come from Neighborhood Brats. Like, the singer, she's a yoga instructor, and I think the guy like sells pickles or something like that.
Well, I got so excited because I read that the singer used to live on the rooftop of Al's Bar. Did you guys know about this?
No.
Al's Bar was just like a legendary, like amazing punk like club, like dive bar in like downtown LA. So I was like, all right, they can record with the Grammy winning producer. That's like serious street cred. That's like worse than street cred. You are like living on the roof of Al's Bar. Like, that's legit.
Sam, how come there's no CD version of this? How come everyone hates CDs? I love CDs.
Because CDs are over. we're not in the what the 2000s. So I listened to this a couple times and I really dig it. I do think it's a very LA thing to produce things with all these Grammy winning people. Because that doesn't happen in the East Coast so much.
Really, I don't know. Doesn't.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because there no one lives on the East Coast. Who knows? I don't know. But it does sound really, really good, and I do really dig it, so I hope everything else sounds as great as I think it should.
Chris, what do you think of Neighborhood Brats?
My two thoughts are, one, I thought it sounded really good, and two, I think pickles are delicious.
Well, speaking of delicious pickles, if you will, the Chumbawamba documentary trailer has been released, and surprisingly, it's not actually a Chumbawamba documentary, even though that's been what has, I guess, been hinted at for the past 3 or 4 years. Rather, Chumbawamba mainstay and one of the many masterminds, Dunstan Bruce, is putting out a documentary, and it is called I Get Knocked Down. And while it does kind of involve Chumbawamba and the history of Chumbawamba, it's really more about Dunstan's life after Chumbawamba and what he's going to do next. The trailer shows that a lot of the members of Chumbawamba get interviewed in it. Alice Nutter, for one. I think Bafo is in there, but also there's Penny Rimbaud of Crass, Sean Forbes of Hardskin, Ian of Fugazi and Minor Threat. So it really does seem to be like, I guess, people reacting to post Chumbawamba rather than here's the history of Chumbawamba. We didn't see Danbert in the video, although they did read a letter written to Danbert's mother, Nigel, because his real name is Nigel Hunter. So I hope Danbert's in it. And Chumbawamba's been pretty quiet. Like, after Chumbawamba broke up, I don't know if they all got along or they all didn't get along. I think they mostly do get along because a lot of them have been on each other's projects. But even then, there might be still some resentment. Like the Beatles hated each other, but they were still on each other's records too. So the question is, I just don't know how much Chumbawamba still gets along, and I hope they get along anyway. Chris, what do you think of Penny Rimbaud's wiener?
I didn't see that twist coming at the end.
Well, listen. What I love about Penny Rimbaud is the real, like, Penny Rimbaud is the ultimate hippie, and he's still the ultimate hippie, and he loves getting. I mean, like if you go to Dial House, there's a 7 out of 8 chance you're going to see Penny Rimbaud gardening naked, if that's what you're into, you know. And so I just love how freaky Penny Rimbaud, I mean, the wonderful thing about Crass is Steve Ignorant is the working class dude that thinks Penny is that Penny's his best friend or one of his best friends. But he also points out that Penny is ridiculous. And I love Penny because Penny is not afraid to be ridiculous and challenge what is reality. And should you have to wear clothes? Penny would argue no. And so Chris, Penny Rimbaud and his nudeness, is that a hilarious an interesting avant-garde artistic statement, or is it potentially threatening in 2021?
I think that in a documentary that's about sort of what is it to be punk, what is it to sell out, I would have to imagine that you're going to have some shocking things in there to see the people who remain from that generation on the sort of fucked up side of the line. So I am not totally shocked to see a naked older person in this trailer. I was actually more, the thing that took me back the most, when it cut to the members of Downtown Boys, I was like, oh, this just went from something that seemed really, really interesting to now I'm intrigued, because I did not see that coming. And I think, you know, the obvious thought is that Downtown Boys might seem like one of the best examples of like a current day anarchist punk band who hasn't, you know, shown up with a hit single on the Billboard charts like Chumbawamba did. So that was really intriguing to me to see that band pop up too.
I agree. That was like kind of, that made like that and seeing like the guy from like Hard Skin. Oh, sorry, you're probably hearing our toilet behind me because I'm recording in the bathroom and like the toilet just decided to start like gurgling. but yeah, like seeing that like the guy from Hard Skin and like Downtown Boys, I'm with you, Chris. Like it already, I thought this movie looks so interesting, like so interesting, and actually kind of fun to talk about it on the same episode, Chris, where we're talking about your comedy like documentary, where you're kind of also like asking questions about like where's my career at now, you know what I mean? This seemed like another artist sort of like doing sort of that a similar thing, kind of like reflecting on their career.
Well, Chumbawamba's been ripping me off for a long time. So.
but listen, I'll just say like, you know, I've met older artists who are like my heroes that, you know, when what I really want to do is like talk to them about new music and new art and the younger, like sort of the young guns that like kind of picked up where they left off. There's just like a lot of older artists that you talk to them and it feels like they didn't stay connected to the scene. They don't know all the amazing artists that they inspired or the people that are like doing the work that they used to do when they were younger and, you know, forgive me, but like a little more relevant. And like there was something about the inclusion of like these younger artists who really are the real deal of like what Chumbawamba was trying to do that I do think made it seem just more like just really cool and really like legit, like a legit discussion about like these ideas. What is it to be an anarchist and an artist who has the potential to have huge commercial success? Like, what do you make of all these, like, you know, those two conflicting ideas in punk rock? And I don't know, like, Chris, I'm making you watch this. We're like definitely watching this. This looks really, really cool.
And more, Chumbawamba, the greatest or the very greatest?
A league all their own. This looks so good. I was doing notes while I was watching it, and I have, in all caps, penis and fully nude. So I had to watch it, I think, twice, because I wasn't expecting that. So I like, oh, okay.
It was also a very blinding penis. Like, when I saw it, it, like, stood out.
So does that make you more or less likely to watch the doc, Sam?
Like, I was reviewing porn or something. But anyways, when I was watching the trailer, the first thing I took was, oh, that dog follows him everywhere because he's such an adorable dog. And then two, I was like, this is so interesting only because, you know, I guess we document on Punk News, like, you know, the height of what bands do and what happens to them during their career as a band, right? I was like, we kind of don't really talk about them after they break up. So it's kind of like interesting to see, I guess, the past. Oh, well, not the past, but like what happens afterwards. And, you know, I think they broke up like a long time ago. So there's been substantial amount of time between then and now. So it is definitely up my alley that I need to watch because of the artsy fartsy factor, and definitely the fact that it's titled I Get Knocked Down seems so fitting for all of us. Just that one line was in the trailer like 50 million times. So I dig this. I'm into it.
Well, I'm definitely checking this out. I do hope like an actual Chumbawamba documentary comes out though, or a book or something. I will say I love that they had the Tub Thumper little kid mask on. And if perchance Penny Rimbaud happens to hear this, Penny, I am not dissing you. I am complimenting you to the highest degree. You are the man, and I love that Penny Rimbaud challenges every aspect of art, be it written, be it sonic, be it clothing. Penny Rimbaud is there to push the boundary and push it into new fields. Speaking of pushing things into new fields and more, play us a tune that will push us into a new sonic sphere.
All right. Well, the past few songs I've played on the podcast have been kind of more like aggressive-ish. So this is a new song from Doom's Children. So Doom's Children is the project by Wade McNeil of Alexis on Fire and Gallows, and also features Pat Bennett, Daniel Romano, and Ian Romano. So it's called Flower Moon. It's their first song, and it's really good, so enjoy it.
Oh,
And there was another fierce track played by M. Moore. Let's talk about something that is a new track, but is it fierce? Turnstile have released their first new song in about 3 years. It's called Mystery, and it's unclear if it's going to be a standalone digital single or something else. If I had to guess, I'd say this is going to be an EP or an album or something like that. I hated it. Hallie Bullet, what'd you think?
Oh, my God, you hated it?
I hated it.
Oh, my God, wait, no. You have to say more. Why did you hate it?
Because, well, on the internet, everyone is like, it's like all the hardcore guys are going to be grumbling because this isn't really hardcore. You know, what a bunch of goblins. Well, first of all, I don't even know why anyone ever called Turnstile hardcore. And you don't have to be hardcore. There are more good bands that are not hardcore than there are good bands that are hardcore. But there are some amazing hardcore bands, of course. But like, I don't, like, everyone always said the Turnstile was hard. Turnstile was never hardcore. They were pop or maybe pop punk. I never heard any hardcore in Turnstile at all. But anyways, here's why I hated this. Everyone's like, oh, this, you know, this is the song of the summer. It's like, this song is kind of bad generic 90s music with a touch of bad generic late 80s music. This is like George Michaels meets like Third Eye Blind or something. Like this is bad, people. And you, deep down, you all know it. It's like some guy singing out like hopeful lyrics. He's like, la. He's like, he's got like this very, I mean, it sounds like Christian rock. I remember when I was like 14, my friend Gray, who wasn't my friend much longer after that, he's like, yeah, look, we should go to a concert. My parents were taking me to a concert. And so I went, and it turned out it was Newsboys, which at the time was like a very famous Christian rock band. And I mean, it wasn't horrible, but it was bad. And honestly, like, it's pretty messed up to like take someone else's kid to a Christian rock concert. You know what I mean? Like, that's messed up. Anyway, that's got nothing to do with this. The point being is this has the hopeful, positive energy, and we're just going to have fun and be positive and we're even going to put in some twinkling synths at the end. You know, this feels like it is written to be played on the radio and not be dangerous or threatening or really make any point. To me, it seems scientifically created to make certain dopamine be released in your bloodstream without really making any point whatsoever that will make you think one way or another. I think it's bland. I think it's boring. And everyone's like, yes, the 90s sound is back. No, the 90s were terrible. Unless your band was called No Doubt or Sublime, if you were a 90s band, you were terrible. I'm sorry. You know what I mean? So, yes, I don't like this album.
Wait a minute. What 90s music have you been listening to?
Bush.
There's so much good music in the 90s. Did you just, like, listen to all the bad stuff? What are you talking about? There's an entire decade of amazing music.
Like what?
I mean, all the everything, indie rock, Pavement, Pixies, any of that.
Yeah, but see, I would say Pixies are 80s, you see.
Also Nirvana, like also grunge, like everything,
Well, I do like the Melvins. I'm not.
The Melvins are salvaging the 90s for you.
I'm being inflammatory to prove a point, and really I'm just being reactionary because everyone loved this, and I hear this, and I'm like, this is just bland radio rock. So honestly, I'm destroying the 90s unfairly, much like Alexander attacked the city of Tyre, and I. Honestly, the 90s had a lot of great music. The Melvins, you know, Buzz Osborne. DFL. Lots of great bands from the 90s. Sublime, no doubt. I'm trying to think of some others, and I'm not doing that good.
Peg Boy. I mean, so much good music in the 90s.
Presidents of the United States of America, Ween. All great bands, but all bands that started in the 80s. The point being, though, is I didn't hate this, but I thought it was cheesy and stupid, and I don't know why this is in the punk discourse at all, except for people say it's punk. And not everything has to be punk. I mean, everything has to be punk. I love lots of non-punk music, but I feel though this is marketed as punk to make people think that it's something subversive or dangerous or interesting when it's just bland radio rock. That's what I think it is.
I loved it. I loved it so much. I hope it's radio rock because I want it to play on the radio and I want to crank down my windows and I want to play it at full blast. I absolutely loved this song. I thought it was fucking awesome. And I like made me wonder if it was like, is this like a The Other Shoe moment for this band? Because I do, in spite of your declaration that this is not a hardcore band, I do think of this as a hardcore band, but yes, this is like definitely a little more, this is like more genre bending, like kind of doing something a little poppier. And so I'm like definitely wondering if this is going to be some big like crossover hit for this band, and it makes me laugh so hard how much you hated it.
I did hate it.
It's a good song. It's like catchy. It makes you feel good. What's wrong with catchy music, John Gentile?
Well, as you know, Hallie Bullen, I love catchy music, namely Bow Wow Wow.
You do like jungle, catchy music.
See Jungle, see Go Crazy, which is about urban warfare in a post-apocalyptic world. This song is just about how it's fun to hang out with your friends when the windows are down in your car.
And isn't it?
Sam Barrett, I have a feeling where you're going to come out on this tiebreaker. Where do you come out on the tiebreaker?
You know I'm mostly opposite from you when it comes to music. Totally. I listened to the song, then ran out of the office, told my husband this was hot fire and that he needs to pay attention to get me a record one day, and then ran back into the office and listened to it some more. So,
what transpired, yes, Sam.
I thought about this only because in your eyes, it's trashy 90s, 80s music. I'm about the 90s, 80s music right now. So I do like that they took a turn for the poppier, for the, you know, experimental and weird noises realm of things. I have seen them live when they were doing their harder stuff, and I did not like that. So I hope this becomes something that I can actually purchase, because I might have one Turnstile album in my collection one day.
Chris, I'm rapidly losing this battle. Will you reach out your hand in support, or will you kick me down into my grave?
Look, I'm not going to say that you have to like this song. I am going to say that to listen to this song and proclaim it a mix of George Michael and Third Eye Blind is an insane thing to say.
So did you enjoy it, Chris?
I liked it, but you have me nervous to admit that.
Well, you can, no, I'm not trying to bully people into liking things. You know what I mean? I'm not going to bully you, Chris. You can say, Chris, this is a safe space. I will not say anything negative after you talk about the virtues of this track. So please be honest. That's what we want, is honesty here.
I really enjoyed it. I thought that
Chris, you're wrong. No, I'm kidding. I'm done.
I thought that intro where it was kind of like all synths and then the song like kicked through the synths, I thought that was a little unnecessary, but then it got going and I was like, yeah, all right. It sort of reminds me, I guess, kind of like maybe like a little George Michael, a little Third Eye Blind.
And more, my partner in the extreme, where are we at with this?
Well, Turnstile are one of those bands I've always meant to check out, and I haven't. So this was the first time listening to them. So I listened to the song, and I was like, oh, okay, that is this how they sound all the time? So then I listened to Time and Space, and I thought that was really good. I thought that was good. I listened to the song, I think, maybe 5 times, and honestly, it didn't stick. Like, it sounds okay, but, like, it didn't go through my head. I wasn't thinking about it. It was just like, oh, cool, that happened, you know, and then moved on. So I understand the appeal of it, but I wasn't the world's biggest fan.
I'm impressed that you listened to something 5 times that you were not sold on. I mean it. I'm not that open-minded. If I listen to something a couple times and it hasn't gotten me by then, I'm like, goodbye.
Just giving it, like, opportunity to stick.
Yes.
It wasn't.
And Moore is nothing if not diligent in regards to the Punk News podcast, namely her notes regarding Penny Rimbaud. Very thorough and detailed. Speaking of things that did stick, Moore, tell us about Cherum and their new track, Listening to My Head.
Oh, yes. Okay. So they are out of, where are they out of? Derry in Northern Ireland. And they're a pop punk band, and they're a trio. So the song is Listening to My Head, and it's a fun song. It's pop punk. It's just, it's energetic. They're not taking themselves too seriously. They're just having fun. I thought it was good. And it's nice to see bands who are doing that, who are making, like, fun music and, you know, kind of not really like reviving stuff, but kind of reviving stuff with bringing like kind of classic-ish like pop punk sounds back. So I thought that was really cool. The lead singer has a great voice. And they have a new EP coming out soon, which is coming out in the fall. So that's something to watch out for. Yeah.
Sammy B, you're a fan of the pop punk.
I am a fan of the pop punk, and I dug this. I listened to it a couple times, not five though, but a couple. and I did really enjoy it. So I'll check out that EP when it comes out. I do see that they're traveling sometime in the fall in the UK, which I hope actually happens because, you know, things need to start to happen. So yeah, that's, yeah.
Chris, famously, you are a fan of the New Jersey pop punk, but this is somewhat different than pop punk as you and I might think of it.
It's true. I greatly enjoyed this. My grandfather's from Northern Ireland, so I was very intrigued to see a Northern Irish pop punk band. And I have like many people of Irish ancestry in America have a great affinity for it, even though the Irish don't care and don't particularly like that we're constantly trying to glom on and claim we're still Irish. That being said, I thought it was good pop punk. Dare I say it, it reminded me of one of my favorite bands, The Unlovables.
I also thought it sounded like The Unlovables. Yeah, I liked it. It was like a little too poppy for me, and I do often think that when people compare bands to The Unlovables, and it makes me wonder if someone just played me The Unlovables that wasn't my band, would I like it? It's just a really, 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 really sugary. But I obviously like that kind of music. I made it for like decades. I made sugary pop punk for decades. I think this is probably definitely for me, and I just need to like listen to it again. It was like maybe I just was like had listened to too much Turnstile, and I just like couldn't even take in any more awesome music for the night.
Well, could it also be that like your ears changed? Like you're just into different things now?
Yeah, I think so. Like I'm sure if I had heard this back in the day, like back when I was making like The Unlovables music, I'm sure I would have flipped out for it totally.
How did you collect records?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. Like, Chris and I, like, we combined our record collections. So we have, like, 100 million records. But we still haven't, like, I don't know. We still haven't, like, quite got our, like, we just got a dope turntable. But now we're, like, having trouble, like connecting it to our Sonos. It's, like, a whole thing. So we're, like, yes, we have, like, a huge record collection that we just, like, don't really very often listen to, and it's, like, really a crying shame. So we're, like, working on it.
Also, our son keeps trying to destroy our turntable, too.
Yes.
So do you guys have, like, a ton of, like, obscure pop punk, or like, what's in the collection between you two?
Everything. Our collection is all over the map, which I'm actually kind of proud of. It's like we have like old like soul stuff and like a ton. I have such a great 7-inch collection of like pop punk from the 90s, which was a great decade for music. And yeah, like Chris has a ton of stuff from when he was coming up as a punk, and I don't know. Also, like, I just found like a great box of records like on the street one time that I'm pretty sure had probably been stolen from someone's apartment and then like left on the street by a junkie. But I was like, well, I really don't think that the person whose records these are is like walking up and down the street looking for it. So I took it. So I have like a ton of interesting, cool stuff, like random, like an amazing Billy Idol picture disc. Like I have like great, and Chris has like a ton of really interesting old like Smith stuff too, and
yeah,
and Jay Church stuff too, right, Chris?
A lot of Smiths and a lot of Jay Church. That's probably most of my vinyl that I bought and contributed, and then you know scattered things I like. But I had a crazy thing happen that was kind of a weird dream where I lived in Woodside, Queens, which is not a hip neighborhood. And I was walking down my block and I saw these cardboard boxes and they're full of albums. And I was like, oh, that's weird. And then went up. I was like, I wonder if there's anything good, but I don't expect like a hip record collection to be sitting on a curb in Woodside. But I went through this thing. There were tons of Black Flag records.
What?
Replacements. Like all the David Bowie records. Talking what? Heads. Like like tons of old Rough Trade stuff. It was.
What year is this?
This was, let's see, I moved out of that apartment in 2012. I probably found all these records in like 2010. Whoa. And initially I was like, they must have bed bugs, man. So I started going through and looking real careful. And all I can think of is like, there must have been a divorce or a death, because if you collected all those records and you want to get rid of them, you know you can go sell them. And in New York City, there's no shortage of stores that would buy those off you. Like, we have I have a record collection that makes me look much, much cooler than I am, and it's because someone died in Woodside, Queens.
What if some guy was just like moving? He's like, I'll just put these here while I go get my keys. And he goes back out and his records are missing.
I do also think there was this like window where it just seemed like everything was on CD. I mean, they're like, those of us that are old enough do remember there was an era when vinyl just to some people seemed kind of useless and like, well, when am I going to listen to these again? And I do think like a lot of really great shit just got left on the street. It was insane.
Well, that was mainly the 90s when the CD boom happened, you know?
Yeah.
And then like in the 2000s, like closer to the, you know, 2010s, that's when like vinyl started being a thing again. And then now it's just crazy. Like everything's $30. I have no idea why.
Yeah. Now no one is finding boxes of records on the street anymore.
No.
Boxes of good records.
Yeah. Everything is on the internet or in a record store at this point.
I guess last question for Hallie and Chris. Between the two of you, what are the crown jewels of the record collection? I know you guys got that awesome signed Go-Go's record, but what else are the real heavy hitters? And not necessarily money wise, you know, just enjoyment wise, you know, or rarity wise.
I have one that I found in London. I don't know if it's a common thing or if I just got very lucky, but there's the Smiths, either their second, third, or fourth show of one of their very, very early shows was recorded. And it's this one that notoriously, before they play Handsome Devil, Morrissey says into the mic, the only thing to be in 1983 is handsome. And then they launch into Handsome Devil, which I think it doesn't make much sense, but I think it's amazing. I think it's amazing. And I didn't know that someone had bootlegged that show and pressed it onto vinyl, but I have a vinyl pressing of the Smith, like one of the very first Smith shows. And that's one that I hold on to pretty tight.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you probably said mine, John. Like my Beauty and the Beat signed by the Go-Go's is like, that's my crowning jewel. In fact, like I have it in a frame. So now when I want to listen to it, I have to take it out of the frame. Like I basically have to find like another and like an empty cover to put the actual record in and then remember that it's there so that it's not so difficult for me to listen to the record.
Well said. And listen, man, I could talk about records for hours and I have. But listen, let's play a song. We'll come back and we'll wrap this up. You know, better leave them wanting something than giving them too much, you know. So let's see. And more, you haven't played anything yet, right?
I did. Yeah.
Oh, Sam, you haven't played anything yet, right?
No.
Kick I'll it. What do we got, Sam?
Yeah. So we started talking about news with the Linda Lindas. So I'm going to play Never Say Never, which is on their EP.
And that was the Linda Lindas. First of all, Chris, thank you for being on the show. Hopefully you'll come back again sometime, and maybe sometime we'll just rap about records the whole time or something.
Or ancient battle tactics.
Or oh, my two favorite topics. So listen, people, check out Chris's new special, Half My Life. It's funny. It's interesting. It's unusual. It's real cool. Penny Rimbaud would approve. I dig it a lot. Check that out. Sam Barrett, any last words for the listeners?
Be good, please. Be safe, please. Wear a mask. Thanks.
And more. And anything you want the listeners to know?
I agree with what Sam said. Also, stay hydrated.
And you can always reach that podcast at punknews.org. Hallie Bullitt, last word to you. And what song should we sail out with this week?
My final words are, well, like, Chris was on a podcast earlier this week, and he talked about our favorite snack. And then, like, magically, just, like, they heard about it and then sent us a giant box of free snacks. It was better than Christmas. I'm so excited. So now I'm just sitting here thinking about, like, what other things do I like that we should just start talking about on the off chance that I get? Like, is there some other snack that I'm really in the mood for? Or, Chris, what other snacks do we like besides this Himalayan pink salt that we have, like, a lifetime supply of?
From the Lesser Evil Company, which I want to reiterate. You know, I said it on Tom Sharpling's show. I'll say it here again. It's a great snack. And if they want to send us another box of stuff, I'd be totally down to have it. Is this weird to beg for corporate products on a punk podcast? Maybe.
What else am I really like? Oh. I love that, like, reduced sugar candy. Oh,
no, you know what we have name. To say, Hallie? If there's remember. Any... No, wait, I'm... If there's anybody out there listening from the So Delicious ice cream brand that makes the cashew milk caramel ice cream, I'll be a happy corporate shill for your product. That stuff's good.
Oh, my God, you guys. Chris and I cannot stop eating this cashew milk ice cream that's like the salted caramel flavor. I was just saying last night that I would eat it over any dairy ice cream any day of the week. So, yeah, wouldn't it be so good if we just got some free ice cream for talking about that shit? It's probably not gonna happen. So I had two ideas of what I might want to play as my song. One was a Linda song off their EP, so Sam has covered that for me. And the other one was the Turnstile song, which is gonna make John so angry, which I don't really want to make John angry, but I don't know. Listen, that was the only other idea I had.
That's my preferred state of mind, being angry. So listen, let's just the self-inflicted punishment. Here's the new Turnstile track, people. See you next week.